All right, folks. I'm excited to introduce here Mike Lee to the What the Futures podcast. Mike, we've got growers across Western Canada tuning in, and I wanted to give you a little bit of background here, and I like to ramble, but I'll turn it over to you in a second. But anyways, I used to be a grain marketing advisor for farmers across the prairies. Okay, and there was a year, I can't remember what year it was, but I did not see this massive Russian wheat crop that was being produced that year. It got printed in the USDA. Pardon me?
Last year, yeah, before last, yeah.
It was a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Actually, this probably goes back to like, I was consulting for a while. So this might even be like when was that really big Russian wheat crop? It would have been like 2014 or 2013 or somewhere back there.
Yeah, I haven't got the figures in front of me. I thought you were talking about the recent 2022 big Russian wheat crop, which, you know, it was some of the sources of that wheat were perhaps not Russian in origin.
Yes. That one I saw coming because I follow you now. So, but back then I missed it, and the wheat market got just crushed here in Western Canada. And I said, I need to figure out how to track this Russian and Ukraine wheat totals. I need a pulse over there. And I found this fellow jumping in a car, traveling 3,000 miles or kilometers, I don't know what it was necessarily, across Russia, doing these crop checks. And that's when I started to follow you and subscribe to your journey. So, Mike, welcome to the show. Are you still jumping in that car and cruising?
No, we're not. You're right. We used to travel 3,000, 4,000 kilometers across Ukraine and Russia. And then several years ago, we were about to embark on our annual frequent crop tour, and COVID arrived. Yep. And I was actually in Moldova at the time, and I was on my way to Russia, but I realized that COVID was going to be a bigger issue than we'd anticipated. And I thought I'd better come back to the UK. So I think I got the last ticket on the last plane out of Moldova to get back to the UK. And we were in lockdown for, what was it, 2 years or something?
Oh, yeah.
Then after that, 2 years later, I thought we'd restart the crop tours, and then Russia invaded Ukraine. So that was the end of that. So no, we haven't been able to get on the ground the way that we used to.
Incredible that back then, the journey you guys would take multiple times a year, right? You'd go. It's on my bucket list. When next time you figure out how to get over there, when things, I don't know, when this world starts to smarten up a little bit, maybe. Mm-hmm. Keep me a seat, because I'm coming with you.
The way that I approached it, my background is in agronomy, and I worked with businesses in Ukraine up until 2014, when the revolution, the latest revolution, took place. And things went a bit crazy, and the investors that I was working with all pulled out of Ukraine, basically. So we found ourselves at a loose end. But I sort of thought what would be good would be to travel across Ukraine and Russia the way that you would approach a farm as an agronomy, you know, package. As an agronomist, you would arrive on the farm and you'd travel across the farm to get a representative sample of the crops to enable you to make your agronomic decisions. Mm-hmm. So I tried to emulate the same process, but over 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 kilometers. You would usually start in southern Russia, down by Krasnodar and Rostov, and then travel north to central Russia, and then basically turn left at a place called Voronezh, head across to Kursk, cross the border into Ukraine, which was always good fun, and then travel from there to Kiev before turning south and heading to Odessa, where we complete the tour. And that would take 7, 8, 9, 10 days, depending on how we how we travel. But and by the end of that that period, I used techniques to score the crops to try and keep bringing an objective or subjective view on the crop condition. So we would measure and score the crops, and we'd stop and look at the plants and that, you know, that sort of thing. But just like on a farm agronomy visit, by the time you get to the end of the visit, you've got this mental picture of what the crops look like. And then we'd analyze the figures and see whether that related to what we thought we saw.
Sure.
So there was an element of leaning on the farm gate and just looking at crops and going, well, you know, good, bad, better than last year.
Yeah.
And I kind of worked that enabled me to then extrapolate that into crop forecasts and confirm or deny some of the market rumors that were flying around about, you know, crop condition in various parts of that part of the world. So that was the sort of the basic idea behind it.
Yeah. Do you have any like a highlight from those trips? I can't even recall how many trips you've made.
Dozens.
Does anything stand out from a highlight on one of those journeys?
I keep promising to myself to sit down one day and start writing a book about this, because there's just one story after another. And every trip I went on, you know, you think, you know, what's going to happen on this trip that's, you know, surpasses the previous trips? And there was always something that would come. I mean, I can't think of anything, you know, that stands out at the moment, but just the whole trip and experience, you know, there would be
you
know, crazy stuff going on, mad stuff that just makes you, you know, you just look at it and go, what on earth is going on here? But I mean, it's fairly routine to me. You know, I would take people with me, people like, you know, yourself, people with an interest in the region, and I would take people with me to help share the costs as much as anything. Yeah. But with seats in the car, so took grain traders, farmers, academics, reporters, and they come along and experience it. But I think what I would emphasize was, we're going to be in a car for a lot of time, and we're going to cover a lot of, you know, ground. There is no way, you know, there's no way around it, really. We, you know, we would 8-9 o'clock, we'd be in the car and we'd drive till, you know, 10 o'clock at night and to the next place and find a hotel and get some food and beer and then get up in the morning and repeat the process. And I think by the end of the experience, most people were fairly, you know, they were glad to finish in Odessa, to say the least.
Yeah. Would you get like a special like car? Would you pick up like some used car somewhere to do this? Or was there a rental car? How would you figure out?
I'd like to say we had, you know, sort of top of the range SUVs and things like this, but it's a combination of people I know, contacts, you know, with beat up old larders. So it was a mixed bag, really, but it was very, you know, it wasn't an extravagant exercise by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. That's great. So obviously things have changed and evolved. So what are you doing in 2024 here when it comes to checking in on these crops? Are you still have contacts in Ukraine and Russia and having a good handle on what's going on over there?
We do. And it's surprising how much you can tell from a photograph if it's taken at the right angle and of a crop. You know, you can look at things, so you know, as an agronomist, you can draw things out of that. We've had to adapt, basically, and you know, we like a lot of analysts, we're trying to assess the crop from a distance, which is not ideal. You know, our USP was that we would have boots on the ground and we'd be there physically, not just once a year, but several times through the season. So we'd follow the crops through the sort of the key stages, and that gives you an impression of what, you know, what the crop looks like compared to what it looked like previously. But obviously we can't do that at the moment. I am toying with the idea of going to Ukraine this year to try and see what's going on there. But obviously that kind of depends on how things develop. I do manage a small farm for a client in Moldova, which is a small country sandwiched between Romania and Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So I'm out there several times a year looking at the farm there. And I know people in Romania where I visit them as well. So it's not Ukraine, it's not Russia, which is much further east, but it still gives me a feel for the season. Sure. You know, the season's progressing. So that's a useful exercise. So a combination of looking at remote data, feedback from people on the ground that are in the countries that we're talking about, and trying to get to the periphery of those regions, if you like, to where we I actively farm, bring all those things together. And having spent many years growing crops in Ukraine and working in Russia, it all sort of comes together and gives me a fairly confident assessment of crop conditions and yield forecasts. I mean, yield forecasts are, to some extent, it's an academic exercise because everybody's forecasting yields all the way through the season. And the, you know, one analyst says the yield's going up or it's going down, it gets reported and the market may or may not react to that. And then by the time you get to the actual harvest and the crop is gathered and then it's adjusted for bunker weight, for clean weight, you know, it's sort of 6-12 months down the line, and then the official number comes out, and it bears generally bears little resemblance to what the forecasts were being made earlier in the season. So I think what we add to it is we're looking to see where the, you know, is it going up or down in terms of crop potential. And I think for me, one of the biggest benefits is that we can confirm or deny the remote data. So the EU have a satellite that produces lots of pretty maps and big, red areas. They say there's a problem, the crop's dry, and it's, and you look at the map and you go, oh my gosh, it must be, you know, terrible. And then you drive through the region and you go, it's it's fine. You know, it's the colors on a map don't really sort of relate to what's happening on the ground. It might have been drier, the yield might have been, you know, suppressed a little bit, but not it isn't all dead, put it that way.
Do you have, Mike, do you have a sense of how the farmers in Ukraine are doing at this time as we enter 2024 growing season? Like we hear that they're planting more rapeseed, it's easier to move. Do you have any sense on what kind of what they're dealing with right now, or how their day-to-day is going?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The farmers have adapted to the situation. They're growing, they're moving away from the crops that are bulky, that need to be transported, corn as well, going for crops like canola, rapeseed, sunflower seed. Wheat area, they continue to plant wheat because it's a good proportion of the cropping rotation.
Sure.
And it's a relatively cheap crop to grow. You can use home safe seed. You don't need any fertilizer in the autumn. You can just apply one herbicide in the spring, and if you've got some fertilizer, you can put it on and you'll get a crop.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're trying to grow a crop of corn, you need to buy seed, which is, you know, generally more expensive and it's more responsive to P and K. And then you've got this 5, 6, 7, 8 ton crop per hectare that needs to be transported and dried and so on. So the farmers have sort of adapted in a pragmatic capacity. But I think the issue that stands out for me is that the supply chain is working. So seeds, fertilizers, chemicals are broadly available. Credit is available. It's expensive, but it is available. So the system is operating. But I think the real problem for the farm, another issue that stands out is labor. You know, there's a lot of people that have gone off to fight the war, and you know, so there's that sort of practical issue. But coming back to the sort of the broader farm prospect. The problem is cash or lack of cash. Farmers in the first stages of the war, they struggled to sell the crop. Then the ports were open and then closed and open again. And then grain starts to move and they're getting paid. But they're getting paid, you know, below the cost of production. And they're having to take the hit because they need the cash to pay for the the inputs from the previous season, or to buy diesel and pay staff to harvest the crop and bring it in. So, and we're now entering we've entered the third year of the war. So this is the third agricultural year. And farms are struggling financially. That's the real issue. And, I've seen figures stating that, you know, X percentage of farms are going bust. There's no reliable data on this, but anecdotal information tells me it's a problem. Okay. Somebody I spoke to recently said, you know, if we're farming to survive, and if we didn't have to pay rents on the land, we wouldn't plant crops. We just hunker down and do nothing. So it's, difficult to say the least.
Is there any, I don't even know how to ask this, but is there any relief like from the government at all possible? Or obviously they've got their hands tied with the war, but is there any support for farmers?
There's announcements all the time, and there always is in places like Ukraine, about how the government is helping out farmers. And the years that I worked in Ukraine, I never saw any of these announcements turn into actual, you know, cash dollars coming into the farm. So there's a lot of things talked about. USDA, Japan Emergency Aid Fund, Australians, I think Canada's there as well. So there is money coming in and some practical support in terms of there were some generators supplied to farms in the east this week. I think they came from Germany. Okay. Ag bags, the silo bags have been supplied. USDA funding some seeds and stuff. But I think it's relatively piecemeal, really. You know, it's an admirable effort, but in real terms, I'm not sure that it's, you know, it's a sticking plaster rather than a solution. But I think, you know, obviously the country's trying, but like you say, they've got other priorities.
Yeah. So in 2024, the wheat seed is already planted, winter wheat. They'll be plant. Is the rapeseed and canola? Is it winter canola as well? Are all the seeds in the ground right now, or?
It's winter oilseed rape, winter canola, winter wheat. The winter crops. That's all in the ground. It's all planted in the autumn, and it'll be coming out of the winter as we speak in varying degrees of condition. It should be okay. The winter's not been particularly strong.
Okay.
And then we move into the spring planting from now. I mean, farmers have started planting spring barley.
Okay.
There's a little bit of spring wheat planted, but then it's into the corn and sunflower and soybeans, which are the three big commodity crops. And that sort of kicks off from end of April through May into June. Mm-hmm.
So if you're short on cash, credit's expensive. Do you see any impacts to production through that yet, or is there enough out there where there's enough money or credit to buy fertilizer and to grow a decent sized crop?
The farmers have been relatively fortunate, relatively fortunate in as much as the weather has been reasonably good for last year. So fertilizer rates were cut right back, but the crop yielded pretty well because rainfall, you know, rain makes grain basically. So they got sufficient rainfall at the right time in sufficient quantities that boosted the yield. Which always amazes me when farmers then, you know, we've seen a situation in other parts of Europe where fertilizer prices rose, farmers cut back on the fertilizer, crops yielded quite well, fertilizer prices come down, and they go back to the increase in the fertilizer rates. And I'm thinking, well, if it grows with, you know, if it gets the rain, you know, don't put the fertilizer on it, you know, cut back on some of the costs. Mm-hmm. And I think that has helped in terms of productivity, in terms of production. The season at the moment in Ukraine is looking fairly positive in terms of rainfall through the growing season so far.
Okay.
So, you know, if the pretty much across all of Ukraine, it's above average at this moment. So assuming that that sort of trend continues, that above average growing season rainfall will translate into an above average crop. Sure. Assuming it doesn't turn into a drought between now and the end of harvest and things go backwards. But so it looks like it might be another reasonable yielding year this year. But in terms of inputs, it's a cash business, and without cash, mm-hmm. If you're losing money on every ton that you sell, that's not sustainable. You can't continue to do that for indefinitely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What about in Russia? Is it some of this similar challenges for those growers when it comes to access to cash, or how's it going over in Russia?
It's difficult to get reliable information out of Russia at the moment.
Fair enough.
I spend a lot of time looking at the Ministry of Agriculture websites, and it's just rhetoric, basically. There's very little actual sorts of detail there in terms of costs and state of production and so on. If you do read the websites, if you're sat enough to spend your evenings reading Russian websites on agriculture, you'll find that everything's fantastic. The yields are better than last year, and they're always going to be better, and it just rolls on like that. My job is to sort of sift through that and try and read between the lines and try and get a picture of what's actually happening. But in terms of sort of general farming, there's less issues in Russia. The supply chains have not been damaged or interrupted.
Yep.
And exports are still continuing out of the Black Sea ports. There has been issues with regards the sanctions. There isn't sanctions on the exports of food and agrarian products, but there were sanctions on the financial controls and the ability for business. So basically, it's difficult for traders to pay the traders in Russia. There's no sanction on the exports of grain, but you've got to get the cash to them. So there's sanctions on the banking facilities, insurance of Russian ships going into European ports, and these sorts of what the Russians refer to as hidden sanctions. And they're not hidden; they're quite in your face. You can see them quite clearly. Yep. But those are the sorts of implications that has taken place there. But they seem to have got around that, and the export rates are buoyant for Russia.
Yep. The Ukraine crop is looking okay. Forecast looks not too bad. Is it the same thing for Russia, generally speaking, a decent growing conditions expected?
Yeah. If you think of Russia as sort of three growing regions, is the way I think of it. You've got the south, central, and the eastern, or the Volga regions. It's a very, very simplistic generalization. But if you get all of those three areas working, yielding reasonably well, then you've got a record yield coming in. What tends to happen is one of those regions will underperform. Two will perform reasonably well. One will underperform. And then you get this sort of average wheat yield or crop yield. And then if you get two of those regions underperform, you get a below average crop yield. So if we're thinking of wheat in particular, most of the wheat is grown in southern Russia and central Russia. And the spring wheat is planted in the eastern part of Russia, the Volga region. So that is yet to go in. But the winter wheat that was planted in the south and central has gone through a fairly benign winter. Plenty of snow to cover the crop, protect it, and that's added to the moisture levels, the soil moisture levels. So, by and large, as far as we can tell, the two winter wheat growing regions are looking reasonably well. Okay. So now we need to turn our attention to the spring crop that will make or break give us an average or above average yield production in Russia.
When it comes to the mix of crops that they're growing in Russia, has that changed at all with the war in Ukraine, or is it pretty consistent, or do we know?
I should have looked this up before we jumped on the podcast, but Off the top of my head, it's reasonably consistent. You get increases, decreases year on year between crops, but I don't recollect seeing any correlation between the war and any significant changes to crops that are being grown in Russia. Sure. The area is constantly increasing. They're looking to grow more and more crops. They're looking to open up eastern, far east of Russia. And there's, there has been talk of an extra, 10 million hectares of crop land and things like this. I think that's all a bit pie in the sky. It's all a bit, over embellished. But if you look at the oblasts or the districts, the reports that come out from each of the districts, they all talk about, increasing crop production. That's the message is coming from the Kremlin, from Moscow, is grow more crops. But those crops will be grown on the more marginal land. There's a reason why they don't grow crops there now, because it's marginal land. So while the area is looking to increase, it doesn't correlate that the yield will go up proportional.
Right. Yeah. Fair enough. You look across the globe, and it doesn't matter if you're in, it's different reasons, but it's expensive to grow a crop, and obviously commodity prices have been trending lower here for the last couple of years. Economics are tough all over the place, so it's to see expansion is.
Well, my answer to that is don't spend money on the crop. We have the one thing that we've got control of as a farmer, as an agronomist, is how much money you spend. Mm-hmm. So you can limit what you spend. And this isn't meant to sound simplistic or not having a go at anybody in particular. But when I first went to Moldova, I was asked to go there because the business was losing money, and the reason we were losing money is because they were spending too much for the crop yield that they were receiving. So you need to put your cloth to fit. And we went from losing money on every ton of wheat that was grown to now we target 3 tons of wheat to the hectare, and the costs are broadly 1 ton. So for every 3 tons we grow, we make a profit of 2 tons, whatever price we sell that for. So that works as a system. But we mintill, we don't put anything on in the autumn. We come back in the spring with a herbicide and a relatively small amount of fertilizer, and that's it. I could quite easily, the local agronomists are constantly trying to sell me more product to put on the crop, but I'm not going to get a yield much more than 3 tons, 3.5 tons, because we don't get the rainfall. So That's the way I look at it. I know it's a generalization and simplification of a complex subject, but you can't control the weather, you can't control the prices. So the one thing you can control is how much you spend.
Yeah, and I think that I see, after a few years of strong commodity prices, operations are going to have to look internal. And I said on the podcast a couple episodes ago that you need to evaluate and reevaluate everything that you've done or you're doing to make sure that when you're putting a dollar out, you're getting that plus back. And we've got some tough years ahead of us. So there's going to be all sorts of learning opportunities here for growers over the next couple of years, in my opinion.
The thing that I always keep in my my ear is that whenever I spend money on the farm business, is, does that bring a return? Is that going to make a return? So that helps as a are you going to spend money? Are you going to get are you growing a crop to make it look pretty, or are you trying to get a return on your investment? So there's a lot of things that we spend money on that doesn't bring a return. We like to have nice shiny machines and workshops and tool sheds and things like this, but does it actually bring a return? And invariably when you look into it, it doesn't.
We've got some interesting times ahead for sure. Well, maybe one last one here on my side for today, but and I don't want to get you too far in the weeds when it comes to politics and everything going on, but we see a lot of tension in the news when it comes to farmers and government across Europe. I know we could go down all sorts of maybe bunny trails here, but is there anything that you'd want to mention or talk about in regards to that? The news is blowing up all the time about a protest here and there. How's it going over there?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's developed, started gaining traction last July, in Eastern Europe in particular. And there were protests before that in the Netherlands and one or two other places. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of issues that are layered on top of each other or interwoven that aren't necessarily connected, but they are sort of overlapping each other. If you look at the situation in Europe, as in the EU, there's farmers there that have an issue with the greening of the CAP, the Common Agricultural Policy. They've got issues there. You can argue whether the issue is a valid issue, but they've got an issue with it. So it's a valid protest, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And what Europe needs to do, or the European Union needs to do and appears to have done, is to sort of rail back on some of the changes to the Common Agricultural Policy. I don't think they should rail back on them completely, because I think broadly, creating a more sustainable farming system is the ultimate goal in all of this. So there's that issue. There's issues that are getting a bit clouded and confused about governments wanting to take land off farmers and so on.
Yeah.
And, finish farming and make everybody eat bugs. And then you start going down these rabbit holes and conspiracy theories. So there's that going on as well. And then over in the Eastern Europe, the countries that border Ukraine, Romania, Hungary, Poland, Slovakia, they've had some issues with what they perceive as cheap imports coming out of Ukraine and flooding their market and suppressing their prices. Right. The Ukrainian Ministry of Agriculture have come out this last few weeks with sort of counter arguments and counterpoints that, the quantity of grain that's coming out of Ukraine is not as much as coming out of other countries. There's suggestions that some of the processes have people who are not farmers that are getting involved with the right wing, or there has been suggestions that the Russians have been involved. I haven't seen any evidence to this, but it's all smoke and mirrors and conspiracy and so on and so forth. But that issue gets wrapped up with the legitimate European farmers protests. So it starts to get a bit clouded and confused. And then we've got issues here in the UK where farmers in Wales in particular are unhappy about the similar sort of situation with the agricultural policy.
Okay.
So it's a very confusing situation which has valid protests in it and some issues that have subversive or ulterior motives. And it's difficult to sort of, find the truth in amongst all of this. But I think if we're looking specifically with the grain coming out of Ukraine, I'm not convinced. Prices haven't collapsed or dropped in Eastern Europe just because of the grain coming out of Ukraine. It's linked to the world market. That's what's driving this. I mean, I get it. It has an impact locally on the domestic prices in these countries. But that's not the core reason, behind this, and it's going to continue. I think the last time I looked, Poland was blockaded Ukraine, but Ukraine was saying that there's Russian wheat coming through Belarus and the Baltic countries into Europe. So if you're going to block Ukrainian wheat, what about this Russian wheat that's coming out of coming through Belarus and the Baltic countries? So there's a lot of conspiracy claim, counterclaim. Propaganda and it's not straightforward, I think, is the conclusion.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, I appreciate you shedding some insight on that for us as well. So it doesn't matter where you look right now, there's tension all over the world, all over the globe when it comes to farming and government policy. And it just seems that tension's continuing to grow in many areas. So, Mike, I appreciate you coming on the show. We've been going here for over 30 minutes already. How can people stay in touch with you? How can they get your latest information? What's the best way for farmers if they want to know what's happening in Russia, Ukraine, so on and so forth? How can they be in touch with you?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned farmers. What we would like to do ultimately is give our service away free to farmers, because I think they're the ones that would benefit from it. The grain trade can pay for it because they can afford it, but yep. Farmers,
I like that.
Or struggle to find the cost, but they would be the ones that would benefit from the information. And it's not one piece of information, it's not just one forecast, it's just being aware of what's going on in the world, the competition. Is out there. You know, we compete on a global market. To enable you to understand your business, you need to understand what's going on in other countries, particularly these big grain producing regions of Ukraine and Russia. What you do is difficult. The next stage is the difficult part. But at least being informed is part of the process.
Yeah.
Having said that, we can't give it away for free because we've got kids to bring up and bills to pay and stuff. Yeah. But we have a website called Black Sea Crop Forecasts .com. Okay. And on there there's a link to the subscription page, and you can go on there, and for 40 British pounds a month or 395 British pounds a year, you can subscribe to that service. And what we do is we produce regular updates 3, 4, 5 times a week. Try and keep it down to one page so that it's, we get the detail rather than embellish it, so yes. That it's a sort of at a glance sort of approach to follow what's going on. And we include our crop forecasts as well and other bits of information in there. And we're thinking of doing a podcast ourselves as well.
Perfect.
So we're trying to develop that business. And what I say to farmers is, several of you could get together, get one subscription, and we haven't got any hard and fast rules, but you could have 5 people, say, on one subscription, so you could share the information, and then it wouldn't be a huge cost. And it would help us, support us to continue to develop what we're doing. And when the world returns to some sort of normality, we can get boots back on the ground and do what we, what we did before.
Yeah, you bet. Awesome, Mike. Again, thank you so much for joining the show. I appreciate the work you guys do. And like you said, a 1-page, 2-page, they're a great quick read with all the important information. So I'll put the website in the show notes as well. Hopefully you can join me again one day in the near future. And if you need any tips on setting up a podcast, I'm not an expert yet. I'm only on episode 18, but I'm certainly willing to lend a hand if I can. So thank you so much, Mike. Appreciate everything you guys do over there.
Thank you.